and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Amy Papageorge. Please go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for Cigna's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series. My name is Amy Papageorge, and I'm a therapist and care manager for the outpatient substance abuse team at Cigna. Due to the format of this seminar, you will not be able to ask questions during the talk, but there will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end. Following today's presentation, you will be asked to participate in a brief five-question survey so that we can get your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will be able to ask our speaker questions regarding his talk. Please limit your questions to the seminar topic. If you have specific questions regarding substance abuse treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. There's a PowerPoint for today's seminar available online. To access the PowerPoint, go to www.cigna.com/substanceabuse and then click on today's presentation. Again, that's www.cigna.com/substanceabuse and then click on today's presentation. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Timothy Trail. Tim is involved in neurological-based research and is currently conducting neurotherapy at the University of North Texas. He is the coordinator for the Substance Abuse Resource Center at UNT and sits on the Subcommittee for Recovery in Higher Education for the State of Texas. Tim presents research at national conferences and regularly speaks in community programs as well as addiction treatment centers. Tim?
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate it. Well, I'd like to welcome hopefully some of you back that heard me before, and for those of you on the first time, welcome. And I tend to talk a little bit kind of from just the way I think, which is pretty normal. I don't use big words, those kind of things. And that's the way I like it, and that's kind of how I learn and spread the word. So that's kind of how it'll be today. So it should be pretty easy to go along with everything. Today we're talking about changing the addicted brain, specifically through alternative techniques, not necessarily other than like Alcoholics Anonymous and those kind of programs, but these are things that can be added on. These are things that are not in the mainstream yet, but that have some research behind them, or we've seen some success with them. So this is a good chance to learn some alternatives on just how to maintain sobriety, also how to change brain structure, how to kind of get your brain back to a healthy place, or help those if your family members are visiting here and listening. These are some things that are pretty easy, some of them, that you can learn and apply, those kind of things. So I'm going to go through some of the basics on the brain part, because that's really important, whether I'm talking to someone who has experienced substance abuse, addictions, those kind of things, or a family member who is dealing with their family member who's addicted maybe, or professors, doctors, treatment centers, licensed chemical dependency counselors, whatever. These things, I believe, are very, very important. It just kind of, I've really seen a lot of pressure sometimes will be let off of people when they realize how deep this goes and what it can really look like in the brain. And as well, from the counselor side or the doctor side or the treatment center side, it kind of opens up a new understanding of why a person is the way they are and how much further you can go in sobriety or supporting sobriety as well as actual neurological healing, which is the brain becoming healthier after someone has stopped using or drinking or whatever. So on your PowerPoint, I'll kind of read through or at least tell you some of the basics on each PowerPoint, because I know not everyone's going to be able to access them. And just for some people who may have visual impairment or something, I'll try to describe each slide also. So the first slide is just the title and my title. And the actual title is Changing the Addicted Brain, New Techniques for Maintaining Sobriety. So the next slide is just kind of a splash page, and it really lists a lot of the words or a lot of the programs that are associated with addictions, when you hear it or when you talk about it or when you start to try to pick this whole thing apart, because it can be very deep and there's so many options. So we'll have things like the words like hope. There's a question that says, does brain structure actually influence changes of drug or alcohol abuse or addiction? So is there actual structural change is what it's asking. Hitting rock bottom and all these kind of catchphrases we hear all the time, rehab, recovery, willpower. I hear that one a lot from family members. Well, when they decide not to use anymore, maybe not so, it's not so clear as that. And often it's not as easy to do that as you may think. Too weak, I hear that a lot of times. Not as much anymore as information is spread, but I'll hear, oh, they're just weak-minded, or oh, they have a weak personality, a weak character, blah, blah, blah. Nah, not really true. I mean, they may, but that really doesn't have anything to do with kind of where you're at and that thing. So that's more of just a personal thing. So, you know, it's more into brain structure. That's what we kind of want to get into. So the next slide, I used this before, and I use it a lot because people really like it, but it's Homer Simpson, and it's an X-ray of Homer Simpson's head, and he has a really big head, and he's got this little tiny brain that's about 1 inch big inside of it. And the title of the slide is The Important Brain Stuff. The brain is terribly important, actually, when we're talking about addiction. So, and before I go on, I just wanted to say one more thing. I had one more thing. I've kind of changed up my presentation this time, and I've added a student in my office. And her name's Misty, and she's listening along and watching the PowerPoint with me. And as she has questions about things, because she hasn't really been formally trained in these kind of things, she's just been kind of hanging out with me. So as she may have some questions, I'm assuming that those are some basic questions that you guys might have. So hopefully we'll kind of cover those as we go along. And I've allowed her to just kind of chime in at any time. And I'll repeat what she asks so you can hear it. So the next slide is called The Four Major Areas. And it shows a head and the inside of a brain roughly. It's just a graphic. And number one is the cerebral cortex. This is the front part of your head, front part of your brain. It's just under your forehead, and it goes back a few inches. And most people know that this is where executive decision lies. That means self-awareness, logic, inhibitions, those kind of things, judgment. The next number back, number two, is the limbic system. The limbic system is almost directly in the center of your head. The limbic system is really fight, flight, freeze. Some of you may have heard that, but that's more of the instinctual part of the brain. So if we're scared by something, that part of the brain acts first, and that's what makes us defend ourselves or you know, do what we need to do to keep that, whatever that threat is. It's also where pleasure is, reward. So sex is in there. If you won the lottery, that thing would be lighting up like a pinball machine. Those kind of things. And that's also traditionally where most people believe the seat of addiction is. And that is a big part of it. And that's because that's where reward is. And anything that we believe rewards us or it activates this limbic center automatically, even if it's on a subconscious level sometimes, we don't always know this, but that limbic system wants that reward. And it's going to seek out that reward, even if it's on a small level, but it's going to want that reward again. And so you can see how it starts to tie in already, even just in that little explanation. So in the limbic system, you've got threat responses, pleasure, reward, anxiety, rage is in there, emotional memory, so anything that's highly emotional is in the limbic system, that memory. And so when it calls back to that memory, like if we saw a big bear and it scared us pretty bad, then that is where emotional memory is by many is believed to set. And so we'll activate in that area if we see something else that's big and brown, let's say. And that says, oh, could be there. And so we're ready to you know, jump into action if we need to. Number three is sort of at the base of the head, in the back part of the brain, and it kind of above the neck in the back. And that's where the autonomic nervous system is. It's kind of a little bit more in there, but this is just a general picture. The autonomic nervous system is those are the things, and actually down in the medulla and stuff, those are the areas of the brain that we used to think that we had no control over. Those were like heart rate and your temperature, those kind of things. I mean, other than breathing and stuff. Blood pressure kind of is regulated there. Those kind of things. Your core body temperature is regulated there. And we used to think that those were just like, you know, those were things that you could not control. But now we know that you can actually control them fairly easy if you just know how to do it. So, but all of these things tie together, especially in addiction. Now, the next slide is kind of where we break that down even a little more. The next slide shows three brains. They're all the same brain, but they're labeled in just the different areas. And this is just to break it down a little more so you'll see it. The first one is blue, and it shows the entire brain. But what you can't really see is that's not on the inside. That's kind of more out towards the skull. And that's a lot of that area, especially in the front, is where logic, focus, higher reasoning, inhibition is very important, and that is in this area. It's actually close to the limbic system, but it's considered in the prefrontal. And inhibition just simply means stopping or you know, keeping your brain from doing stuff that's silly. And we'll get into that a little more. And then the next picture shows the limbic area again, and that's right in the middle of the brain. That's fear, anxiety, sexual behaviors. Motivation can be driven from there. That's where the reward is. And then the back, this just is a little bit clearer diagram to see where they are. And that back one is where the medulla and the lower part of the brain and the back of your head is. Heart rate, blood pressure, breathing, core temperature, all the things we talked about a minute ago. So I'll move right on to the next one. Now, this next slide is going just a little bit deeper, and this is as deep as I'll go as far as science stuff goes, which is it's actually describing those are electric signals that you're looking at. If you can see this, there are four columns that show it's almost like reading an actual computer screen that you guys may have seen, like a heart monitor on TV one time that shows a little blip going across. Well, that's what these look like. There are four of them stacked on top of each other. The first one are really big waves, and that's called delta, which is not really labeled so much, but that's when you're really, really sound asleep. The next one down is called theta. Theta is when, this is an important one, theta is a little bit smaller, but it's still a big wave, and this is when you are asleep, and it can be in that really drowsy stage where you're asleep and almost awake, or awake and almost asleep. It's kind of along in that area. The next one down from that's beta. That's kind of a regular area of when you're thinking normal. And then the fourth one down is really important also. The waves are a lot sharper and a lot closer together, and that's because it's a very high voltage pattern called high beta. High beta is anxiety, normally, I should say. So the two major ones that we most often see in addiction is theta, which is being sleepy or pretty drowsy, or kind of, you know, that unconscious almost state, and high beta, which is anxiety or anxiousness. And so those are the two main ones we see. And if you go to the next slide, it just shows a turtle and a really fast guy being Superman. And so really I'm kind of just hammering this into everyone's noggin because it's really important. So too slow patterns in one part of your brain and too fast patterns in the in another different part of your brain. This is what we're seeing in addictions. Yes, and my student just asked, too slow is theta. Absolutely. So the turtle would be labeled theta, and the person who's just running as fast as they can is high beta. And it's not so much knowing what those are called. You can write it down if you want. It's kind of cool to know that stuff. But really it's having too much slow activity. If you go to the next slide, which shows the brain again, you'll see that I've written too much slow wave activity in the front of our head. That's exactly how I wrote it. And so in that prefrontal cortex I was talking about in the beginning, in the front of your brain is where logic, focus, reasoning, decision-making, all that is. There's too much slow wave activity in a person, let's take alcoholism, for example, or an alcoholic, or a son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter of an alcoholic, we'll see the same pattern normally. Most times we will. And what we see is too much slow or theta in the prefrontal cortex, okay? And then we'll also see too much of that high beta, that fast wave activity, which is like anxiety, in the limbic system, which is fight, flight, and freeze. So what we have is, if you'll go to this next slide, it shows a scale. And what it is it shows that a person has way too much theta and way too much beta in the brain, but in very specific areas. And what this does is, of course, you can imagine that too much theta, too much sleepiness in the area that you focus in and make decisions in, of course, it's going to become harder to focus and harder to make decisions, and it's going to be kind of foggy, right? Well, too much beta in the limbic area is going to really activate some symptoms that are going to kind of push us more towards addictions also. Now, on this one, we have a term called tissue dependency or tissue dependent. And tissue dependence is also known as tolerance. That's why, because I work at a college, and so that's what I hear a ton of people talking about all the time. Oh, I've got tolerance, and I can drink you under the table, blah, blah, blah. Well, the true term that describes tolerance is not really tolerance, it's called tissue dependence. And so tissue dependence is when the body or the brain, in this matter the brain, adapts to a constant presence of a substance. So, and it doesn't have to be every day, and it doesn't have to be tons every day. As long, whatever chemical, whether it's weed or alcohol or Advil, whatever, if there's a chemical introduced into the brain, often enough, the brain will adapt. And that's what the brain does. It constantly adapts to whatever is present there the most. This will blow your mind. Even thoughts. Amazing, right? So if you think something often enough, whether it's negative or positive, whatever, if you think it often enough, it will start to change your brain. Literally, the structure will change slightly. That's just amazing. So keep that in mind when you're thinking positive things about yourself, negative things about yourself. Those things actually affect you if it's done in enough pattern and you say it over and over to yourself enough. Here's the main difference to know about this little nugget of gold. negative thoughts, or if you're being told something negative to you over and over and over, happen to change the brain a lot faster, maybe 3 to 5 times faster than positive. So surrounding yourself with the right people, and this is, can be played into sobriety, and I teach this. When I'm talking to someone who's trying to cut back or who's quit altogether and they're trying to maintain sobriety, the peer recovery group that we have here at the college or AA or whatever, is the things that you tell yourself over and over reinforce. They reinforce your brain in the way that you want it to go or the way you don't want it to go. It's going to reinforce it either way. So that's an important part to know. That's, even what I'm explaining to you now is part of the alternative way of thinking about maintaining sobriety. Because the things I'm telling you, it's not just new groups that are alternatives to AA or something like that. Even the way you think, thinking patterns will change your brain, just like a drinking pattern will, or smoking marijuana pattern, or whatever. Thinking patterns also change your brain. It takes time. So these are... That is an alternative even to know to do that, to build up a healthier brain and to maintain that sobriety. So, again, we've got this scale, so we're showing too much beta and too much theta, and what the brain is doing is it's starting to adjust because that theta and beta being off, that slow and fast, too much slow in one part in the front, too much fast in the middle part of the brain, start to become, since that's a regular pattern, the brain goes, oh, well, shoot, it's supposed to be like that. Oh, cool. Then we'll just keep it that way. So that imbalance that alcoholists take, for example, will make in our brain when we're drinking, especially if it's done on a pattern, the brain will say, this pattern is how it's supposed to be. This is the normal way that the brain is supposed to, that I'm supposed to be, so I'm going to make it and change it this way. And so we start seeing this long-term where the brain stays that way, even when we're not drinking. Now, this is over pattern time. This is as a person does become, start to experience tissue dependency and then on to addictions. So the next slide shows the slow part. The slow part is the frontal, and it says slow in big words, and it says you have too much slow wave activity in the front of your head, too much theta. What this causes is fogginess, impulsivity, motivation goes down, poor decision-making, depression oftentimes will come out here, and reduced memory, of course. And the most important part to know here about the prefrontal cortex, and I mentioned it once before, is that it's one of its main jobs that most people outside of medical or science don't know. Its main job is to inhibit or regulate or boss around, maybe is a better word, the rest of the brain, especially the limbic system, which is anxiety and fear and all those things. So when there's too much slow activity in the prefrontal, it's too sleepy, let's say, to even make a good decision, then that means that the other parts of the brain, specifically the limbic system, which has to do with anxiety and addictions, see, you're hearing what I'm starting to say now? The limbic system, which has to do with anxiety and addictions, starts to be not regulated properly. So the limbic system starts to get stronger, faster. You know what I'm saying? So that's a very important part that we see with having too much slow wave activity in the front of the brain. And I clarified it in my first talk that I did on here, but on this one I haven't so much. So I want to make sure that everyone understands drinking alcohol, especially in any kind of patterned event, like I've got guys and girls, students come here all day long that drink, I only drink on the weekends, I only drink Friday and Saturday, most of them, some of them Thursday, Friday and Saturday. That's a heavy pattern. That's, the brain is getting a chemical in it over and over and over, and so it will start to adjust, even in some lower amounts, because it's changing the chemical, it's putting theta in. That's what happens when you drink. At first, it kind of peps you up. But when a person drinks alcohol and they start getting that buzzed area, and once they start going above that a little bit, it goes into a depressive state. Depressive state is theta, too much theta in the prefrontal cortex. So the more that theta hangs in there because you're drinking, the more that the brain goes, oh, that's normal. And I know this is kind of technical right now and sciencey, but we're going to get away from it. The next slide down is the fast part. The fast part's in the middle, and it shows the same brain, and it shows a fire right in the middle of it, because we see that's really hot. It's what we call it anyway. It's a hot part of the brain, because it's very, very high electrically driven. So it's got a lot of electricity running through it, and it's really pushing the brain. So what we see is it has too much fast wave activity in the limbic system. That's in the middle. That's where the fire is. And so what we see is, if anxiety is in there, anger is in there, memories issues are in there, addictive is in there, it can push impulsivity, get a heightened fight or flight response, stress, all that, see, and, okay, this is a great way to do it. Everyone probably on this call has been around someone who drinks, I'm sure, or at least observed someone, even on TV, whatever. But everyone has also observed or been around that person that, they're mad. When they drink, you don't like being around them because they're mad. Or maybe you yourself, you're on this call listening. And when you or a person you know or a person you've observed, when they drink, they're no fun because they're mad as can be and they want to fight everybody and you're like, get away from me. And that's because exactly what I'm telling you is happening. When that person drinks alcohol, they're having too much slow wave in their prefrontal cortex. And that's what stops that anger from getting out of control. That's what the front of your brain does. It's one of its main jobs. And so when it gets too sleepy or too much theta, or it gets too drunk to do the same thing, which is theta, then it stops regulating that. And that's why it's very difficult to calm down an angry drunk or to keep them from being angry. Or the person who is really, really sad and they just won't stop being sad and everything's a bummer. Same thing. The brain has stopped regulating. The problem we really see is as a person drinks in a solid pattern over and over and over is theta, the brain goes, oh, theta is supposed to be here every weekend. It's probably supposed to be here all the time. So the brain starts making that slow wave activity hang out in the prefrontal even when you're not drinking. Therefore, agitation starts to become stronger, or depression becomes stronger, or depression and anxiety, or just anxiety. But you know, I'm hoping that everyone's kind of getting the picture now. So those things are not being regulated anymore, even when a person's not drinking, because the brain is just not awake enough to regulate that anymore. And those kind of feelings are not controlled by the prefrontal cortex, so they just kind of can do whatever they want. Now, also remember, addictions is in the limbic system. So if that middle part where that fire is on this picture, the middle part, the limbic system, is not being controlled very well anymore, then addictions is not being controlled very well anymore, or kind of the movement towards addictions. Okay? So go to the next slide, and the next slide is kind of just all words. So at the top it says, this combination of slow wave activity in the frontal and fast wave activity in the limbic system, which is the middle of your head, leads to or adds to poor judgment plus lack of reasoning plus diminished self-control or loss of self-control or inhibitions plus a supercharged on-fire limbic system that believes that you have to use eventually. It's going to believe that, like, you know, it's going to start turning into, I need this, because the limbic system is not being controlled and it wants that reward. Plus, the next one down is a feeling of doom if you don't use. And this is all equals out to this horrible feeling of physical experiences that have to be faced if you don't use. So this is real wordy. And so to kind of put it down real easy to where I can understand it, the student in my office can understand it, to where everyone else can pretty much understand it, is this. Too much drinking, too much smoking weed, too much cocaine, too much whatever is going to lead to a lot of theta or even different slower waves, actually, in the prefrontal cortex. And so all this simply is this is a gatekeeper or a guard. And the guard at the front gate, it can't keep the gate doors down anymore, can't keep the gate closed or the front door locked and closed anymore, so anything can come in and out. And so it's kind of like letting the monster out of the box. You can't stop it anymore because you're just too sleepy to do it. So when you're drinking, you mean? Yeah, okay. So the question is where does it start when you're drinking? And actually, when you take a drink of alcohol, it really mimics the same thing that happens in addictions also. So it's later also. So when you take a drink of alcohol, the very first thing that is influenced is the prefrontal cortex. That's why judgment goes down and people make silly mistakes and do silly stuff. Next is the limbic system. It kind of activates from front to back of the head. So the next thing that is affected by drinking too much alcohol is your limbic system. And so at first people make silly decisions or kind of giggly. They may get a little tired or whatever. It was a little different. But that's the first part of it. And then as a person gets more drunk, you'll probably notice that they start making really dumb decisions. This is where the angry drunk comes out, or this is where the sad drunk comes out, or this is where the person hangs all over you and they won't get off of you because they think you're the greatest person in the world. And that's because the prefrontal is kind of is wiped at that point. In a manner of speaking, it's kind of sleepy and tired and drunk. Yeah, it's got too much theta. And so it's not stopping the limbic system from doing what it's doing anymore. And then if a person continues to get drunker than that, then it starts going back to the autonomic nervous system, which is where it's very dangerous. that's where alcohol poisoning is. That alcohol poisoning is simply your autonomic nervous system going, you know what, I'm going to sleep too. I'm going to pass out too. If that passes out, that's what controls your heart rate. That's what controls your core temperature, your breathing. So when a person dies of alcohol poisoning, that's usually what they're dying of. If they're so drunk at that point that their whole brain is kind of going, I'm passing out. And if that part passes out, you're in trouble. So easy way to remember it is too much sleepiness in the prefrontal stops the middle part of your brain from doing whatever the heck it wants to do. And as a person drinks too often, too much, that becomes out of control. And then the limbic system really wants that reward. It wants that alcohol. The prefrontal really stops having the ability to say, hey, that's not very logical. You shouldn't drink in the morning every day, you know, because that logic starts to go away. It starts, and it's losing the ability, its policing ability, to stop the rest of the brain from doing whatever it wants. So, and I don't want to go too deep into it. You can ask all the questions you want. You can email me questions, whatever, and I'll answer anything you want to, but I don't want to stay too deep into the brain stuff. Go to the next slide. It says equals addiction. So that's all that one slide really was, is just that movement often enough at a pattern will eventually lead someone to addictions. Now, my next slide is we're going more into the avenues of recovery. Now, we're getting away from the sciencey stuff a little bit. And so the normal avenues of recovery on this slide, we have AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, we have NA, Narcotics Anonymous, going to a hospital, mostly for detox, but there are hospitals that will do treatment and, you know, and this kind of thing, do outpatient, things like that. Then we got counseling, which I love. I think counseling is wonderful. Face-to-face is awesome. You can also drastically change your environment. That's a technique that I've seen a few times, when that means just people get up, they're not around their friends anymore, they're not in the same environment that they could get whatever drug they're into. They completely uproot themselves and move to a new spot. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, because the problem with, you don't have access as much, but the problem is that the brain has changed. And so those neural pathways, those new structures in the brain, those new wants, those new yearnings and desire to use, that addiction is still there. And it still is kind of gnawing away, and you still feel it, kind of feel anxiety, and you can still feel that you want that thing more than anything in the world. So without some other help or other avenues to help stay in recovery, sometimes that's just not enough. Sometimes it is. Everyone's different. There's a billion ways of recovery. We're finding that out more and more every day. Religion is another one, or social saturation, meaning you just completely saturate yourself in an environment where no one drinks. You know, it's completely wrong, or it's completely not looked on in a good way, which can be healthy for the person because they don't drink anymore, but you also want to be really careful. Just because of the morals, usually too much moral stigmas or ethical pushes don't stop at just drinking. They go in every part of your life. Not that I'm against religion at all. It's just, you know, be as intelligent as you possibly can be about it. And weigh things, with all of these things, weigh out what works the best for you and kind of keeps you in a healthy life, of quality of life, that also helps you to stay in recovery. The next one is getting into a relationship. Not so healthy. This is one of the things that we tell people when they come into treatment is, hey, listen, you don't need to have sex with anyone and you don't need to get in a relationship for at least a year. Some say more, some say 2 years. And the reason is I've worked in addictions a long time. I've worked in facilities and treatment facilities. And what I see is one of the very first things people do when they get sober or get clean is look for someone to madly fall in love with and pour everything they have into that person emotionally, and they love them. And the problem is they're really just meeting that dopamine rush or that need of a heightened limbic experience. They're still meeting it. And that's what sex is. That's what a really, really passionate relationship is. It has worked for some people in the past. I'm not saying it doesn't, but chances are not real great. Because you can only love someone that you don't know and only pour out so much passion if you're doing it to meet your own need for so long. And eventually, that is not going to be there as much. And then you're looking at trouble and people who are trying to stay in recovery. Relationship trouble usually or can lead back to wanting to use again. So that's not a real safe one to go for. And then the other one is replacing the addiction with basically another addiction. It says with a different habit. But some people do that. Some people go work out, which you can work out way too much. Some people will eat way too much. Some people will start smoking the heck out of cigarettes. And, you know, those are things to be careful for. There are avenues that people use, though, so I have them on here. The more traditional ones, AA, NA, hospitals, treatment centers, counseling, those kind of things are the big ones, and those are the ones we've seen a lot of success with. Now, if you go to the next one, here's where many people who are in treatment or many people who get into any of these avenues find themselves struggling for a long time afterwards. Some people a whole lifetime, some people for as many years, some people for years. And it says one big issue is, I'm just going to read it out because not everybody can get the slide. It says, even though a person stops or cuts back use, the brain imbalances will often stay close to the same. And I should have put can be for an extended period of time, and it's different for everyone. Many people, though, it will last for a good while. As the brain tries to come back to its old self, a lot of those structures are still there, and they're still firing, and you're still wanting, and you're still, you know, things will trigger wanting to use and those kind of things. And that's because that structure is still there that has been built. Structures don't go away. They just get really, 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 really weak if you do it right. I mean, you pretty much don't even know it's there anymore. And it says, this leaves behind, and it's a whole list of things that it can leave behind, depression, anger, confusion, anxiety, bipolar-type symptoms, very, very, very common in people who are in alcohol, have experienced alcoholism, dulled effects, feeling very dull, not emotional at all, and the inability to control emotions. So this happens quite often in early times of sobriety or being clean, is a person will start experiencing emotional floods that they haven't experienced for a really long time off of a substance. So all of a sudden they'll be crying for no reason, or they'll be, you know, they'll joy for no reason. And that's because the brain's trying to balance. Or ADHD symptoms, so not being able to sit down, not being able to focus on something. I got to get up. Oh, I can't do this. I got to get up. Oh, my gosh, I can't write this paper because I got to get up. Oh, my, I can't sit down. And for those of you who do not know what ADHD is electrically in the brain, for most people, almost all, so there's a little differential in some, but almost all, it's too much theta in the prefrontal cortex and too much high beta in the limbic system, which is what I just explained to you what addiction was. Just on a different level, and that's all. So you can see if these patterns maintain for too long, all these things can be left behind. That's why I wanted to give you guys a few alternatives. And the next page is just a guy on a road with three different directions. And it says alternatives that help balance out our brain or help to maintain sobriety. AA is awesome. There's a good bit of research in it. The problem that I have, that I have seen with AA, is not AA itself, is that some people, when I said they replace one habit with another, that's what it is. They'll go to, you know, I know some people that have got 25 years sober, but they spend 6 or 7 times a day in an AA facility, and their families are, you know, we're sitting down and having a family counseling session, and the child's going, you know, well, first it was this, or a wife's going, first it was this, and now it's this. What's the difference? They're not here anyway. And it's not AA itself. It's not getting, you know, not healing up that brain more, activating the prefrontal cortex and bringing it back up to a healthy state. So please don't get me wrong, because I know AA and NA can get me. So the next slide is alternative groups to AA and NA. And this is just two. You can look up tons of them. Smart Recovery. Smart Recovery. Now, here's where we're getting into the alternatives. Now, this is to help maintain sobriety. Smart Recovery. And you don't have to go to Smart Recovery or AA. You can go to Smart Recovery and AA. It doesn't matter. There are 100 ways, paths to healthy living and to sobriety. It's what works best for you. Combining them often is probably the best way to do it, in my opinion at least. So Smart Recovery is pretty unique. It's been around for a while. I am Smart Recovery certified. I had one of my the other employees that works under me, I had her get Smart Recovery certified, and that's because we want to offer as many options as we can for people. We have AA groups here, NA group kind of groups. We have Smart Recovery groups. And Smart Recovery is simply, it's done in groups, the same as AA, but they look at it from a more scientific and research-based, they explain the neurological symptoms. The things that I've just explained to you, they kind of dive into that a lot more. They're into self-empowerment, which AA is they kind of take a different angle at it, but, you know, whatever. Saying, you know, you can add them and you can build on this foundation of AA if that's what you're in, or you can go to Smart Recovery and build on that foundation with AA, whatever. But it really looks at the science-based understructures of addiction. And I like it because it helps a person to really understand addiction, kind of like I explained to you guys today. Understanding it neurologically often gives a person understanding that it's not just free will. I'm just not making bad decisions. Maybe you made a bad decision the first, you know, when you're in college or whenever you started drinking, you're sure. But at some point, when that brain structure changes, limbic system does what it wants to do. You don't tell it what to do. It does what it wants to do. And if it's not being controlled, it will get stronger and stronger. You see what I mean? So free will, being a weak person, all that garbage we've heard for so long, those stigmas that are put onto people, that's why Alcoholics Anonymous has anonymous in it, because we have this huge stigma on addictions. It's, you know, I mean, our school, most colleges, addictions has only been included into mental health in the last few years. That's ridiculous, in my opinion, of course, but, but you know, that's so new. We've known it for so long. And so these are some of the ways we can get by this stuff, is understanding it. Another one is called Path to Wellness. There are a ton out there. You can look up alternatives to AA, alternatives to NA, and there are a ton. Path to Wellness is based on science, mostly on a probably 80% on science and about 20% on philosophies like Buddhism, things like that, or Christianity, based not on the religious aspects, but on the philosophy part, on acceptance of where you're at, on, you know, I accept that I'm here, but I can move on. And then knowing that science part, this is how I can move on. This is how I can get better, or how I can change my brain. So the next one is called, and it speaks on mindful meditation. Mindful meditation is wonderful, and CORE is right underneath it, which is called Conditioned Object-Oriented Relaxation. Conditioned Object-Oriented Relaxation. All it is mindful meditation with an object in your hand that you focus on. And what you're doing, just like a chemical in your brain, like alcohol or whatever, has influenced your brain and changed it to behave a certain way and want certain things and want to get certain things to make it feel a certain way. This is the same thing. Mindful meditation, there is a ton of science behind this. Not religious meditation at all. This is breathing. 6 to 7 seconds per, 6 to 7 breaths per minute is optimal, what we've seen in research, and being very, very focused on how you feel, being very present in this moment. Know how your shoulders feel, how your neck feels, how the brow, you know, when you get all worried, your brow crinkles up. Realize that. Recognize that. Know what it feels like when you relax. And please email me, write me, ask me tons of questions. I'll tell you tons of stuff. I'll give you one great one and we'll move on. A very typical, huge mistake that we make is we try to clear our minds. I have a great friend who is a Buddhist monk from Tibet, and he laughs all the time because he said that's pretty much an American idea. Because you can't clear your mind. Your mind works all the time, even when you're asleep. Actually, it works more when you're asleep in Delta than it does any other time of the day. So, you know, knowing little things like that, don't get frustrated because you can't clear your mind. You're not supposed to anyway. Look into it. There's tons of apps, smartphone apps, all these great things. But core method, if anybody wants to know, it's a great method. It's just conditioning the mind to go to relaxation really, really quickly. It's really easy. Write me. I actually came up with it myself, and it works wonders. I got quite a few people use it now. Quite a few doctors I know are using it. Just email me, whatever, and I'll absolutely give you direction. I'll do it. It's real, real, real easy. The next slide is neurofeedback. Neurofeedback, if you go to the next slide, here is what someone's brain looks like with addictions, that top level. See all that red up there? There's a big red stripe down the middle. The one in the front, all the red up front, that probably more than likely is someone's tension, because most people with high anxiety have a lot of tension in their forehead. So some of that up there is more tension, but that red line down the middle that goes back to that limbic system. Remember, the limbic's in the middle of your head, right in the center of your head. That's going right up over it. We see that in addictions. Neurofeedback, you can get on the BCIA's website, or ISNR. BCIA, you just type in that in Google or whatever search engine you have. Go to BCIA, go to practitioner. It'll show you the practitioners in the United States who do it. It's simply conditioning. There's no operations. There's no putting electric in your brain. None of that stuff. It's simply showing a person how to change their brain waves, how to lower theta in the prefrontal cortex, and how to lower beta, high beta in the limbic system, in our case of addictions. That's what I do, one of the things I do, and I regularly have seen people with depression change. No medication anymore, no depression. I've seen people with addictions. I've seen people with anxiety. I've seen people with anxiety and depression. I've seen people with brain injuries. It all has to do with that electrical wave. And if you are shown how to change it and it takes off, it's phenomenal, huge changes. If you go to the next slide, this just shows you a very neat thing. Once an addictive brain, in this particular sense, this person was really addicted, right? And they beat it, or whatever they want to call it, long-term recovery is what they're in now. But some of that theta stayed. You see in that left area on the head, their left? That's depression. And that stayed. All that theta lingered there, and it didn't go away. And so these are one of the things neurofeedback can help with. We've seen mindful meditation help with this kind of stuff. Going in and activating the prefrontal, learning new things, like going to smart recovery, learning science, going to passive wellness, learning the science behind it and stuff. That activates your prefrontal cortex, makes it stronger. So we're looking at long-term recovery. And I know I rushed through some of this, but I wanted to leave enough time for everything to get done. So the next two slides are just stuff. My phone number's on there, and then also my email address. I can give out later, or Amy can give it out if you guys want it, or whatever. I don't mind. Any questions at all. So, but I want to cut off now because I want to have time for questions. So, Amy, go ahead.
Actually, we're going to go to our survey real quick, and then we'll do questions.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. For our first survey question, this session provided me with information about alternative methods of substance abuse treatment. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. For our next question, this session educated me about the impact of drug and alcohol abuse on the brain. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Now for our next question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. For our next one. I recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And now for our final survey question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Press star 1, I am a person with a substance abuse issue. Star 2, I'm a family member of someone with a substance abuse issue. Star 3, I'm a treatment provider for someone with a substance abuse issue. Or star 4 for other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 to have your line opened into the conference. And we'll take our first question.
Hi, this is Abby from Cigna Behavioral. Your presentation was very helpful, Tim. And I was wondering if you could repeat that website for finding neurofeedback providers across the U.S.
Yeah. It is called BCIA. You just have to type that in Google. They're the ones. B is in Bravo.
Okay.
C is in Charlie. I is in Indigo. A is in Alpha.
Gotcha. .com.
.org, actually, I think is what they go by. They're the licensing overseers for neurofeedback and biofeedback also.
Great, and we can find out providers in our state, for example, who are licensed.
Yeah,
thank you.
At the top it says find a practitioner. I think you put in your zip code or something. But it's important to have someone who has a license and knows what they're doing or certified, because As you can tell from what I was talking about, if you had really bad depression and I didn't know what I was doing and I treated it the wrong direction, you could possibly become suicidal and not even know why. So it's super effective. It's wonderful. But it's important to have somebody who knows what they're doing.
Great. Thank you.
Ma'am.
We'll take our next question.
Hello, this is Gwen with Cigna. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was wonderful.
Thanks, Gwen.
My question is regarding cognitive therapy. Does that relate to either one of the therapies that you mentioned, or is that something different? If so, do you recommend that?
Like cognitive behavioral or any of the cognitive theories, right?
I guess more like cognitive behavioral therapy.
Cognitive behavioral therapy is incredible. There's a ton of research behind that, as many of the practitioners know. And it does do so well. Personally, just I like to combine things. So in our lab, when we do neurofeedback, usually CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or some sort of cognitive therapy, which is usually more client-centered, is used also. Face-to-face is wonderful, and we see brain changes in people who are given cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah, absolutely, I love it.
Okay, so what does that look like exactly? you were talking a little bit more in depth about what neurofeedback looks like and so forth. With cognitive behavioral therapy, is that, are they giving you something to read? Are you being mentally challenged? What would that look like?
Well, in the brain, it looks like activation in the prefrontal cortex, which is what you want.
Okay.
I mean, that's literally what's happening. Cognitive behavioral therapy, and there's a ton of different, there's so many theories out there, but cognitive behavioral usually is looking at behaviors or the way that, like the way people interpret things. Some of the behavioral therapies will pick up on like cognition, like someone may be a black or white thinker or an all or nothing. So it's like, you know, a lot of people will get into that with addictions. It's like, oh my gosh, either I got a user or I'm going to die. You know, and there's this huge gap. There's no in between. But what we see, a lot of that is driven neurologically. I mean, the brain just thinks that way. If it's set up the way I described it, it's just set up to think that way. And we see cognitive behavioral therapy, and ones under that, like ACT, motivational interviewing, all these other ones that are subcategories of cognitive behavioral therapy, all activate the prefrontal, and we see changes in people pretty consistently also who are kind of wrestling with the addictions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
And once again, press star 1 if you have a question. We'll take our next question.
Hello, I had a question wondering, so this is what you're looking at the brain once it's addicted, but is there a predisposition for certain people to have either genetically low theta waves and high beta, or like if there's an injury to the prefrontal cortex? A lot of times you see these people with addictive behaviors later. Is that something that's possible?
Well, there's so much research around the world on it going on right now. It's so fast. This is what I do know. We do know that there is some genetics, but we just don't understand enough about the genetics yet. Now, what we do know is that, at least from the electrical side, looking at Hertz, is that we know that a child, either an alcoholic or a child of an alcoholic or a grandchild of an alcoholic will have either very little alpha or no alpha in their head at all, and that's 8 to 10 hertz. That's a relaxed state. And so those people tend to be either a little on the tired side, a little going towards the theta side, or most often it seems that they're a little more towards the anxious side. So most of the time when I run into a child or great-grandchild of an alcoholic, they are driven, a little compulsive here and there. They like things in their place. And those kind of things. Now, when a person drinks alcohol, the first half of a drink of a beer or a half a shot, the very first thing that happens in the brain is alpha spikes. So if you have no alpha in your head and it spikes, you feel really good. Not good like cocaine, but good like, I feel normal. I feel very natural. I like this state. Hmm. And so, yeah, that absolutely we've seen that. That's a very strong. And also people with no alpha tend to not get hangovers, so there's no consequences the next morning, and often. And they also can drink a lot more than their buddy next to them. So even when starting, they'll be able to knock back 5 or 6 where their friend will knock back 2 and be falling over when they first start drinking. So, yeah, we see some of those things at least.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, there are no questions. I'll turn the conference over to Ms. Papa George.
Great. Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Tim, for speaking today. If you have additional questions for our speaker, please contact him at the web address or email address, actually, listed on today's PowerPoint. If you have specific questions regarding treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Our next seminar will be on March 19th. If you haven't already done so, feel free to listen to the replays of any of past year's seminars and be sure to sign up to receive automatic email reminders for our upcoming sessions. Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.